The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine. I am Ken Levine, your podcast host. And from time to time, I like to bring on writers whose names you probably have seen, whose work you have seen and laughed at for years, but you might not know them personally. Case in point, Jay Kogan is my guest this week and next, because we had a very nice long conversation, which I am breaking up into two parts. But Jay is an Emmy-winning writer. He was there for the very beginning of The Simpsons. He also worked on Frasier. That's where he won his Emmy. He was on Malcolm in the Middle. He created a number of his own shows. And today, we talk about his comedy background. He comes from a family of comedy. Also, breaking into the business, insights into Gary Shandling, which is really very fascinating, and the birth of The Simpsons. That's this week. Part one, Jay Kogan on Hollywood and Levine. Well, first of all, you come from a very funny family. Your father was and still is a comedy writer, Arnie Kogan, and he wrote for Mad Magazine. And as a kid, I loved Mad Magazine. Man, to have your dad, a writer for Mad Magazine, had to be the coolest thing in the world.
It was briefly a very cool thing. From the ages of probably 9 to 11, having a dad write for Mad was probably pretty cool.
Okay.
To those kids who cared about Mad Magazine, it was awesome.
Okay.
They probably all thought he was Al Jaffe, but it's still, I took it.
So he also did a lot of variety shows and things. Did you grow up like hanging out with Stephen Eady and all those people?
Literally Stephen Eady all the time. Stephen Eady were like my aunt and uncle. Uh-huh. Like I was at their house for high holidays.
Okay.
So like them, specifically Stephen Eady, a lot. And their kids were very good friends of mine and that kind of thing. But I also was on the set of a lot of variety shows. So I knew, you know, Carol Burnett and Tim Conway and Harvey Korman and those people. And I met Jim Nabors and I met a myriad of variety players, the Osmonds.
Okay, you knew him. Even Jimmy?
Not even Jimmy, mostly Jimmy. Like when I hung out, he was my age, so when I hang out with the Osmonds, they'd put me with Jimmy. So that's, I would hang out with them. One of the interesting stories, we had a house in Encino, and my dad did the Jackson 5 summer show.
Okay.
So at some point, over at my house, my parents' house in Encino was myself, my mom, my dad, my sister Jill, and my nana Chicky, with the Jackson 5, with Marlon, Michael Jackson, Tito, and all watching a premiere of the Jackson Summer Show.
Now, how old were you at that time?
I probably was like 12 or 13, but to watch my nana and Tito really get along was cool. You know, they really had a lot to talk about, and that was kind of interesting. And Michael Jackson, very quiet, never hit on me. I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe that was before.
You were cute then,
you
too.
Know, I mean, that may have been before the time things changed for him. But and they're all quiet. They were all, like, very quiet. And clearly, now I know they were all screamed at constantly by their father, and they're afraid. I didn't know at the time. I just thought, oh, they're so shy and sweet. But now I know that they were mortified.
So yeah. Was there a lot of comedy in your house growing up?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's you're a comedy writer. You have comedy writer kids. I mean, it's like it's.
There's a value to it that's present all the time.
It's passed down. Just the daily talk is accompanied by jokes, and the jokes have a rhythm, and the jokes have punchlines at the end, and the jokes have a sort of content to them, a fast back and forth about what you were just talking about. So it's bringing the moment of the conversation into a joke and into a joke form very quickly. And that's what you need to do to be a comedy writer, at least in a comedy writer room. It's very helpful.
Right. And I always said that with my family, it seemed like somebody was always the target. And it could be me.
Yeah.
It could be my wife.
Right.
But somebody was always the target, which we felt was important because the kids had to learn to be able to take it as well as dish it out.
Yeah, that sounds horrible, I gotta say. I don't recall there were too many targets in my house. Yes, there were moments when each one of our foibles...
Making fun of each other and stuff.
We were each made fun of separately, but generally speaking, the jokes were about the thing we were watching or the day or something else. I mean, I particularly was trying to sort of get my father's attention by being funny. So anything we were watching, if we were watching a Danny Kaye movie or a special on TV or something going on outside or a baseball game, the jokes would be about, you know, Davy Lopes and not necessarily about my father. And,
okay. Yeah, we were a tougher room over here.
And the other thing I was going to say is in our house, and I don't know if it's true in your house, that jokes were often met with silence. Like, in other words,
yes.
you'd meet, a joke would be pitched with full enthusiasm, and people would just look at the person making the joke and then turn back and continue talking.
Right.
It would happen so fast, like, yes, we know you're joking, let's move on. We were talking. Like, stop it with your jokes. Stop interrupting us with your jokes.
Right. They'll say, yeah, that was funny.
Yeah.
That
exactly.
was funny, as opposed to real people, where if they hear something funny, they laugh.
Yeah, well, people are pretty sick of your shit at a certain point.
Yeah. By the time you reach 11,
yeah,
you
people
were
sick of my shit. And certainly the worst of it was my father, who constantly made jokes, whose street value of jokes gave us a house and a college and everything,
right.
was massive street value. And in our house was valued very little. Like, uh-huh. it was just like, will you just be part of the conversation, stop making jokes. And of course, that's not his inclination.
Somebody said to my wife once, oh, you must be laughing 24/7.
Right.
And she was like, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
On the inside.
24/7.
Laughing 24/7 on the inside.
So did you always know that you wanted to be a comedy writer? Is that something?
No. That's the opposite of what I wanted to be. I never wanted to be a comedy writer.
What did you want to be?
It's still the last thing I want to be. I want to be anything but a comedy writer. I love show business. I loved watching, going to these shows and watching people perform and thinking that, oh, look how people were making a living doing this. Actors and writers and directors and, comedians and lighting guys and camera guys. It all looked so fun, but the writing looked terrible. The writing looked like...
Hard.
Yeah, hard. And my dad works so hard, and a lot of the time he's trapped alone in a room, you know, and alone. It seemed lonely, and it seemed arduous, and there were deadlines, and he'd work late at night to turn out a draft to get it just right and do the rewrites and sort of really look at it. And it seemed really hard, whereas, you know, Tim Conway would walk in and have fun during the day and rehearse and then go home and have fun. Like, it seemed better.
So you wanted to be an actor originally.
I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be a director. I wanted to be something which seemed more collaborative with people. And I tried that. I was an actor when I was a younger person, and I was a stand-up comedian for a while, and I did all that stuff. And I never really caught on. I never really was able to get... You know, I didn't give it a fair shot, but I was never really let myself become a professional. I became a professional writer. I fell into that before I became a professional anything else. So my writing partner and I, Wally Walidarski, whose real name or original name was Mark Wallace, when I first met him in high school.
Who changes their name from Wallace to...
Well...
I mean, is his, it like reverse Ellis Island?
Exactly.
Yeah.
His original family name was at some point Wolodarski. His father had changed it to Wallace to be more anglicized.
Right.
And he said, I'm changing it back. So he went through... He literally changed it to Mark Wallace Wolodarski. So he kept the last name and added the old name on top of it. And then his writing name he thought would be Wally Wolodarski, which is a very good writing name.
How'd the two of you meet?
We were going to high school together. And
here in L.A.?
In Birmingham High School.
Okay,
yeah,
in Encino.
In Van Nuys.
And, yeah, it's our arch rivals, Taft, yeah.
And we drifted together. We liked the same things. We liked old movies and comedy shows and just we were weird New York transplants. I was born originally in Brooklyn, and he was born in Long Island. And so his dad was in show business, mine was too. So we were buddies for a long time, and we tried to write together in high school at first.
What would you write?
I wrote a Newhart spec.
A spec Newhart. You were in high school, and you wrote a spec Newhart.
A spec Newhart and gave it to my dad. I think with Wally. It could have been with Billy Ray, but maybe it was with Wally. I forgot which who. Either way, it stunk. Either way, it was terrible. My dad, poor my father, who's working on Newhart at the time, his son hands him this piece of shit script and says, Father.
Yeah, but you're 16.
Yeah, but still, how do you tell your son, oh, this is not good?
Right,
And he was very sweet about it. He said, well, you know, this could use some work. And, he tried to be so gentle with me and yet still found up breaking my heart. Saying, this isn't the greatest thing you've ever read. So I put that away. I also wrote a variety show, like a sketch comedy show with Billy Ray, Robbie Fox, Wally Wolodarski, and myself, like a sort of Mad TV, before Mad TV existed, kind of show.
Okay.
And then my dad read that and also didn't like that. So, and all these people became writers at the end.
Sure,
all writers. And then Wally and I always had summer jobs together. We had summer jobs through high school and through college. And then one of our summer jobs in college was working as PAs on It's Gary Shandling Show. And we worked there for a really long time, beyond summer,
right?
Just to stay with it. And then
you were on it, weren't you, a couple of times?
Yeah, I was an actor on it, yeah, a couple of times.
How'd you get that?
They just looked at me and said, you do this. It wasn't like this great...
You didn't do the Meisner method or anything to get in. No,
I was
okay.
Just a chubby kid, and they thought he would look funny in a tight baseball uniform. So they said, oh, we'll get Jay. A lot easier to cast that way than actually hire somebody. So I was Big Grant. I was the adult version of the young boy, Scott Nemus, in the show.
Okay.
And sort of the before and after, and the after is not so good. And my rule about acting is I will take any part, no matter how humiliating, if I don't have to audition. And it still stands today. I don't care what the part is. You know, you have to roll through feces and say you rape somebody. It doesn't matter. I have the job. I'm there. I'll wear my own clothes. I'll know my lines, all that stuff. So Wally and I wind up spending nights, late nights there waiting for scripts to be finished. These were the days when you had to Xerox them and then drive them to people's homes.
Right.
And that was our job. So we stay up late and we started writing those late nights, writing a version of the script of that show, a spec script of that show, and then gave it to them, said, what do you think? And like my father, they said, good, but we don't want it.
Right.
And then,
did you learn stuff from Gary Shandling?
Oh, I learned so much from Gary Shandling.
Like what?
So much good and so much bad. The good was keep working at it. Keep working. Never give up. He never gave up on a screen. Even when things were good, he would still fiddle. He would still work. He would still try to make it better. He cared so much about, the very fact that he had a relationship with me, that he, the star of the show, cared a lot about what I thought, the PA of the show. Mm-hmm. And we knew each other by name, and I was invited to his house, and that his whole, thing wasn't necessarily about fame. It was just about sort of like he was concerned about building himself up as a person, and that was interesting to him. And yet he was driven by this thing to try and be successful. It was interesting to watch this guy work hard, and he was so funny and so smart and always wanted the smarter joke and not just the good joke. The good but smarter joke was what he was after.
What was the bad?
He was tortured. He was a really tortured guy. He tortured himself. He wanted to be Zen. He was a kind of Buddhist. He aimed at being a Buddhist, but everything about his life that I could tell, he hated. So, like, he drove himself nuts. Instead of being at peace with all the things that you could have, and he was very successful, he was a little bit, at least a little bit too very annoyed with everything. Mm-hmm. So the house that he built, he was annoyed. He would give you a tour of his house, room by room, with what he hated about each room.
Uh-huh.
And then say, what do you think? And we'd say, well, you're rich enough to rebuild it. Why don't you do it right? He said, no, I live this. This was the house that he built. I was in Hawaii once. Coincidentally, he was there too. And he pulled me in and he wanted to watch a sunset. And so we watched a sunset. And that was his favorite thing, a Hawaiian sunset. And we watched it and he was at, not great. You know, like he would say, it's like, not great. So to him, he was hoping for something better. So that was the thing about Gary. He was like always looking for that one perfect thing that was never quite there. The older he got, I think the closer he got to satisfied.
Right.
But never quite there.
Kind of the definition of show me an unhappy Jew and I'll show you a happy Jew.
I guess so. It's just his, like you're saying, it's his nature. But I mean, I think there are happy Jews. I think there are actually happy Jews. I've seen it.
Okay. I'm happy.
Yeah, I've seen it.
I'm happy. You seem happy.
I'm pretty happy. Yeah.
You seem pretty happy.
Maybe too happy. You know, I think having a little fire under your belly and a little bit unhappiness drives you somewhere. That's pretty good too.
How did you finally break in? Who finally didn't say this isn't good
enough?
Our
mutual friend Sam Simon.
Okay.
He was a consultant on It's Gary Shandling Show. Mm-hmm. I was showing the second spec script of It's Gary Shandling Show that Wally and I had written. While they rejected the first one, we wrote a second one. And I said, okay, well, this is good enough to show somebody. So I was showing agents and anybody who would look at it.
How old were you at this time?
21.
Okay.
And Sam looked at it and he said, I'm going to show this to the folks at the Tracy Ullman Show. And I went, great. And then he did. And I guess whoever it was, it could have been Heidi or
Ken Esten maybe.
Or Jerry or maybe Jim, whoever looked at it said, yeah, bring him in. And we pitched to Jim and Heidi and Jerry. And
Jerry Belson.
And Ken. Yeah. And Sam, and we pitched sketches, bunch of sketches for the Tracy Ullman Show.
Yeah, we wrote for the Tracy Ullman Show as well.
Mm-hmm. We had 12 sketches to pitch. They picked one. They said, go write that. So we wrote a sketch. We turned it in, and a day later they said, Jerry Belson called us up and said, boys, you're hired. You're going to be rich and miserable for the rest of your life. So they hired us at the lowest, you know, staff writers on the Tracy Ullman Show. And our job was just to churn out material that could be rewritten by much better writers.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we did.
Yeah. Jerry Belson, he used to be the partner of Gary Marshall. And we first worked with him on Cheers.
Yeah.
One of the funniest men I've ever met. And when my son Matthew was born, he sent a gift along with a note that is in his baby book. And the note said, Dear Matthew, always remember I was funnier than your father.
He was hysterical. Jerry was so funny, in fact, that, well, a couple of things about Jerry, who's sadly not with us anymore, but that he was in a rewrite room late at night. He would pitch a joke and we would all die laughing at this funny, funny joke. And then see it the next day, and it would die because only Jerry Belson could tell that joke. He was hysterical, but in his voice, which was this very
whiny voice.
He wasn't Jewish, but he had a whiny Jewish voice.
Yeah.
That was
this guy from El Centro, and he had this whiny voice. But it was like contagious because like Sam adopted it and Heidi adopted it. And so you're sitting in a room with all these people and they're all going, this is really funny. I really like this. Yeah, I think we've got something here.
Wally and I were 21 years old and we were looking at this room of whiny old people and we're thinking, how old What, oh my God, these are the most ancient people in the world. Not realizing that at the time, I think Jerry Pearl was probably like 48 years old.
Yeah, he wasn't on, right. And Heidi was 25 and Sam was 26. Right. Yeah.
So like it was like it seemed shocking to me now that I am in my mid 50s that those people were younger than I was. And oh my God, how old they? So they, so, they were like leaning back, all grasping their bellies as if they all had ulcers and just you know how miserable.
Fetching and
yeah. Yeah, it was crazy. Yeah.
And then from there, I guess you moved on to the Simpsons, right?
Right. Well, Sam, you know, being our leader and helped us really just he was executive producer of became executive producer of the Tracy Ullman Show and then started working on The Simpsons. Brought Wally and I in on the very beginning of the Simpsons. It was Matt and Sam and me and Wally at the very beginning, and they wanted us to help produce the show at the very beginning, and then Gracie Films wanted us to stay on the Tracy Ullman Show, but we wound up consulting on that show the first season and writing two episodes, but we weren't able to sort of supervise, produce, or exec produce with them.
Right.
But it was fun to watch them work and help be part of that creation of Springfield and those characters, and watch Sam and Matt, when they got along, be really creative together and work well together and sort of adopt each other's ideas.
Well, I've always maintained, and I know it's not a popular position within Gracie Films, but I've always maintained that Sam Simon was the real creative voice of The Simpsons.
Why is that not a popular
well,
position at Gracie
they
Films?
They seem to downplay. I mean, he left and it was not a pleasant parting of the ways.
Yeah, but and, I mean, they acknowledge, I mean, at least I've spoken to many of the key players, the Richard Sakais and the Jim Brooks of the world. They acknowledge how much work.
Do they now?
Okay. Sam did.
Because there was, you know, you would read articles.
But that's not from Gracie. That's from the press.
Right. But you would read long articles where Sam was like barely mentioned.
Right. Well, and, that's a much better. I mean, that to yeah. me is just smart marketing. Like to if you have a show, a brand new show that's kind of a hit and you want to market it as something crazy out of the box, do you say veteran Cheers
no,
writer?
No, this was after the fact. This was long after Sam had left.
Okay.
Because like I said, there was a lot of acrimony when
yeah.
when Sam left.
Yeah.
And I think it was kind of reflected in the kind of revised history of The Simpsons. But we wrote episodes very early on in the run.
Yeah.
And my sense is that Sam was really the creative force of that show.
He was certainly one of the main creative forces, but without Matt, I don't think for a long time I dismissed Matt's creative partnership as not as relevant, not nearly as relevant. And over time, I've actually grown to appreciate more of what Matt has done.
Has Matt done that you learned to appreciate?
Well, no, at the beginning. In other words, his spark of weirdness, his insistence that Springfield is a place everywhere, the sort of strange parts about The Simpsons. The originally, Marge, for example, was a rabbit. That big, long, tall, blue hair was covering rabbit ears. Okay?
Okay.
So that's what he thought. That's why she looks that way. The Bride of Frankenstein. She looks that way because she has rabbit ears.
Okay.
Weird little things like that, which never came to pass, but stuff that was in Matt's mind. There's an X factor to The Simpsons that's part of what happened. And Matt drew those five characters. He made that little weird world with him and Paul Germain and David Silverman in the little Tracy Ullman's short pieces.
Right.
That thing had its own life before Sam got a hold of it. Sam redrew those guys. Sam literally sort of reshaped the characters, what they look like.
And added humanity to the
thing. Jim did too. Jim sort of infused humanity to them, but Matt wasn't against that. Matt was all for it not being a cartoon, and Matt was with that group. It wasn't like he was being pulled with it. He was on board with it. So it was like that was a synergy there together until they sort of diverged.
Okay, when they diverged, what was the issue?
Really, the issue was Matt getting all the credit and Sam couldn't handle it.
Okay.
That was really...
Fair enough.
That was the issue. That Gracie Films and everybody else said, we have this perfect guy here, Matt Groening, who is affable as hell, adorable, mm-hmm. really funny, great on TV. Let's ship him out and send him on all these talk shows and be the face of the guy. And he can be like, he can be our Gene Roddenberry. He'll be our, the one hero that created The Simpsons while everybody else will do the work and make this funny show. And it'll be a win-win because he's not necessary for everything, certainly. And meanwhile, the show will go on. And it was great marketing. And Sam Simon, meanwhile, is left behind to do all this work. And he's saying, well, fuck that. And right. when... He actually did get an interview from the L.A. Times or the New York Times. They didn't want to hear from him. They wanted to hear about Matt Groening and how he created it and what was it like to watch the master work. And mm-hmm. it would infuriate Sam. And eventually he got so tired of it and so rich that he just said, I can stop and I will.
And that'll do it for part one of my two-part interview with Jay Kogan. When we return next week, we'll talk about the writing staff of The Simpsons. Also, Frasier, Malcolm in the Middle, and a very interesting chat group that Jay had put together. This was prior to Facebook, but it included such luminaries as Carrie Fisher. And I was fortunate enough to be on that. Ann Coulter was on it for one night, and we just buried her. Anyway, that's next week, part two of my interview with Jay Kogan. Our thanks to Adam and Susie Meister-Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce, and Jason Miller. If you want to get in touch with me for any reason, you can email me at hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. That's hollywoodlevine@outlook.com. I will write you back. I, of course, would love a 5-star review. And you can follow me on Twitter at Ken Levine. Follow me on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Thanks for listening. Catch you again next week, part two with Jay Kogan, right here on
Hollywood and Levine.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on Auto Trader. They're really good at numbers. Auto Trader.